Hey everyone, welcome to Locked On Cavaliers for Tuesday, May 15th. I am Chris Manning, your host from FearTheSword.com, SB Nation's Cleveland Cavaliers site. On today's show, we are breaking down Game 2 and looking at the NBA Draft Lottery with Ashley Bastock, my colleague at Fear the Sword, and also a writer at NEO Sports Insiders. You can find her on Twitter at AshleyBastock42. We talk about Tristan Thompson potentially starting, what rotation adjustments that could mean, LeBron's impact on the game, and a whole bunch more. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Leave that 5-star rating and review. It is the best way to support the podcast. Find the show on Twitter and Facebook at Locked On Cavs. Find me on Twitter and Facebook at CWM Writes. And stay tuned for a whole bunch more content this weekend for The Sword. On tomorrow, on Wednesday, May 15th, you'll have two podcasts. Number one, going up late Tuesday night, probably, is me and Trevor Magnotti on the draft lottery reacting in 10 to 15 minutes on where the Cavs pick falls, doing some early prognostication and looking at the draft. And then Wednesday, a recap of Game 2. We'll have the same quarter-by-quarter breakdown we had for Game 1, plus some insight from myself and Chris Barnwell at the end of the game to look at what's coming ahead in Game 3. Whole bunch more coming this week with everything that's coming. The big break coming this week, so I'll have some detailed dives into the first two games this week. But here's today's show, me and Ashley Bastock, and thanks again for listening.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily podcast on the Cleveland Cavaliers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Ashley, looking at Game 1, let's take a look back at Game 1 before we look ahead to Game 2 and some of the changes that we know are coming. What do you, when you look at Game 1 of that series with the Cavs losing by a significant margin in that series, what for you is the most concerning part of Cleveland going down 1-0?
I mean, I think, and this is hard for me to answer because I genuinely am just like, not in panic mode after Game 1. Like, I think a lot of Twitter and a lot, you know, of people on social media in general were just kind of panicked and writing think pieces about what's wrong with the Cavs and how their problems are now coming back to bite them. But I really just looked at this game as, number one, an effort issue, because to get outscored by like 22 points in the paint and then to only make like 4 3-pointers, a lot of that to me was just effort slash LeBron feeling out what the Celtics were doing. And you know, he even said so much after the game, he's not really concerned, but obviously with all that being said, if the effort's not better, obviously LeBron said he has some, you know, type of a really good idea for how they defended him, what they're going to throw at him. And that's, like I said, my main reason for not being concerned. But, I mean, you do need to see more from the Cavs role players, I think, overall. But how much of Game 1 was just them kind of following LeBron's lead? I think probably like 80% of it was that. So it's kind of hard for me to get all up in arms about this one game. Obviously, you would like to be up 1-0, but that's just not the reality we live in with this team this year.
This has happened before. The Cavs were down 1-0 against the Bulls in 2016. So the year that they came, or 2015, they came back and won that series. The Cavs have had a number of, LeBron is actually 5-0 in his last 5 series in the East where he's been down 1-0. Only one of those is with the Cavs, or 2 of those are against the Cavs, obviously with the Cavs, against Indiana, and then against the Bulls a couple years ago. So they've been in a similar situation before. I tend to agree with you. I need to see Boston do what they did in Game 1 again and see all the bodies they throw at LeBron. With LeBron being fairly passive, it's weird to say LeBron was fully bad, right? Like that LeBron was just entirely useless to some degree. But it's like, we've seen LeBron be better. We've seen LeBron be more aggressive. We've seen what it means when he's more aggressive and how it feeds into everyone else doing better. And Boston deserves credit. They played a really good game. They did things that I think the Cavs do have to adjust to. But I think you're right. It's like the Cavs missed a lot of shots. They missed some shots I feel like they might make in some normal circumstances. J.R. Smith was awful. And then LeBron was not dominant LeBron. And when the Cavs don't have dominant LeBron, we know what that means for them. It says a lot about this team that they sort of need that guy, even against a Boston team that's missing two key players, obviously, but that's just feels like where we are with this Cavs team.
Yeah, and I mean, when you look at LeBron's stat line, the two things that stood out to me, obviously the 7 turnovers, which we've seen LeBron have sloppy games like that this year when he has to handle the ball this much. But, you know, the reality situation is that's the position LeBron wants to be in. And whether Marcus Morris and Boston as a whole was making him uncomfortable, like I said before, I'm kind of confident that LeBron's going to figure it out. And whether that's, you know, when we see George Hill playing with LeBron, a lot of times we see George Hill bring the ball up and then, but LeBron's the one who runs the offense. He's the one that gets the play call, you know, if there even is a play call, or just goes into ISO. But so that's what I mean by LeBron wanting to be in that position. Do I think he comes into game two and has 7 turnovers? No. But the other thing that stood out to me was only 16 field goal attempts. Like, he averages almost 30 shots a game. So for him to basically get half of what he averages says a lot, like you were saying, Chris, about his aggressiveness overall. And I think that if you really want to find any kind of silver lining in what is one of his worst playoff stat lines in years, just the sheer number of shot attempts is it.
We're going to come back to LeBron in again a little bit, but I'm going to point out to something that Joe Vardon wrote, just to kind of, he had a really good point about this. It said, usually when LeBron has these kind of games, the next game he does something legendary. That's what Tristan Thompson said on Monday. But at the same time, we can't rely on that. And then Kevin Love added, I expect him to have a big response. He's always done it even before he came back to Cleveland. And since I've been here, he's always responded big. Imagine it'll be a lot like game 2 against Indiana. So for context, in game 2 against Indiana, LeBron scored the first 16 points to that game, and then he finished with 46 on the night. He was, if he had that kind of effort in game 2 against Boston, it wouldn't surprise me to look at game 2. We don't know 100% for sure yet because it's Ty Lue, and Ty does not like to say exactly what he's going to do up until the game, but all indications are that Tristan Thompson is going to start game 2. A, do you think this is a good move? And B, how do you think this affects the type of rotations we're going to see from Ty and in this series and from this team? Who do you think could be inserted or pulled out of the rotation as a result?
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with the decision for kind of the same reasoning that Ty gave at practice. And it's because you need somebody to stop Al Horford. And Kevin Love is not that person for, you know, obvious reasons of what we've seen yesterday. But, you know, Ty brought up with what advanced analytics the Cavs have. Over the last 3 years, Tristan has been the most effective against Horford on defense out of all of the players in the league who guarded him for at least 30 possessions. And I mean, obviously, one of the ways that shows is that before last night, Al Horford in, you know, 2 seasons with the Hawks and then last season with the Celtics as well, had a 1-12 record against the Cavs in those 3 years. So Tristan really does, you know, have a negative effect on his play. Yesterday, he didn't even get a shot up when Tristan guarded him for 12 possessions. So, you know, I tend to be a fan of that move. I kind of like how Ty has played this situation throughout the playoffs. Like, he kept him on the bench for most of the Indiana series. He brings him in. Number one, Tristan is fired up. And number two, it gives you a different look that you need when you kind of have to play bully ball a little bit in the paint, which Kevin Love just, you know, when he says he doesn't like to play the 5, that's what he means. He doesn't want to bang around down low. And then with the Al Horford matchup, you have somebody that's, you know, just as good or maybe a little bit better than him out on the perimeter. So I am, you know, a fan of that lineup change. Looking at who might bump out of the rotation, I obviously don't think it adds anybody because Ty did say right now he's sticking with the 9-man rotation. Wouldn't it be surprising to see him drop that down to 8? I I think Rodney Hood is still on the hot seat. He didn't have a terrible game yesterday.
He was better than Jordan Clarkson. Like, not that it's saying a whole lot, but like, I think if right now, if it was me, I would say just based on one game and based on how they play, and especially in the series where Boston is going to maximize on bad decisions, and frankly, Jordan Clarkson's more prone to bad decisions than Rodney Hood. It's just in his nature. I think Clarkson should be on the river, but I agree with you. I think based on what we know about Ty, even if Rodney kind of did what Ty's been asking him to do for a long time now in game one, it does still seem like Rodney would be the guy that if they are going to trim it down to eight, he would be the guy.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know off the top of my head what kind of numbers Clarkson had. And obviously, this sample size, we can't put too much on it, right? But that first game when these new guys played was against Boston in February. And Rodney Hood in that game had 15 points in like 19 minutes. So through two games against Boston with the Cavs, he hasn't done terribly. Now, whether or not he can keep that up, obviously, would be the key here. But yeah, you know, just knowing how Ty is and kind of how set in his ways, I mean, look at what Tristan did and how effective he's been and done what they've needed him to do, and Ty's still back and forth on him sometimes. So, you know, I guess we'll just have to kind of wait and see. I don't think Tristan's addition adds anybody to the rotation. I don't think we see them go back to a 10-man rotation for really any reason though going forward.
I would not be surprised if we see Larry Nance, though. That's kind of the other guy that I think is interesting here, because he's one of the Cavs' better athletes, and I do think he is limited, and he's had not the best play necessarily since that hamstring injury. He's been a different guy since then. I do think his athleticism could make an impact. I do think that he could have some of the same success against Horford. He's smart enough. I know his statistics would say he's a bit foul prone, but I do think there's something to be said that he could be someone that could make an impact there as well. He would give you another big. It would allow Kevin to play at the four. It would give you another guy that would give you that rebounding advantage that we saw worked really well late in the Indiana series that when Tristan and Love really pushed the boards together. I wonder if that's something that they would see too. For me, I think we'll at least in game two, we probably see a lot of the similar stuff, but I just think maybe on Virg. I know he wants to play Kevin at the five, but if the move to start Tristan is saying, okay, we need to have Horford, someone guarding Horford all the time, and Al's going to play 30 something minutes or whatever, and they're going to play Baines, especially if Baines plays, I wonder if Nance has to play just based on, okay, they don't want to. Even if it's for 6 minutes, I wonder if they need him to be out there just to have a body out there. Love versus Baines could become a small thing that forces Boston to not play him as much, which is probably a win for the Cavs, but maybe this helps set that up to some degree. But I think maybe you do see Nance in game two, even if it's for just a couple minutes. I wonder if we do see some other adjustments as a result of this, right? Like Tristan has normally been a guy that comes in fairly early in the game. He was the first sub along with Jeff Green for game one. I could be wrong about that, but if that's the case, when does he sub out and what other changes do we see as a result? Even if it's the same players, will be, I think, one of the key things to watching game two and how they do, because if this doesn't work, Ty will have from Tuesday to Saturday to tinker. He will have time to look at this in game one, see what worked, see what didn't, and then tinker from there. So game two will kind of give him an idea of what at least might work, but even if some of it doesn't work, at least have some time to sift through it. That's at least the one positive of that big break. I don't, as a someone who wants the series to go a little bit faster, I don't love that big break, but I do, from a coaching standpoint, I think that probably benefits Ty. It benefits Brad too, but I think Ty will benefit from that big break to evaluate what works in game two.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And then on the other side of that is, okay, if the Cavs decide we're going to go bigger, we're for sure going to play Tristan a lot more, we might add Larry in there into the mix. You know, that is going to affect Austin's rotation. I think in that case, you almost do have to play Baines more. And then if you do that, it kind of slows down everything that Boston wants to do. So if, you know, push comes to shove and Brad Stevens decides to go to that, I actually think, you know, Boston going bigger is going to be a benefit in the Cavs' favor.
Who besides LeBron in game two, and let's say besides Kevin Love as well, because I think that's just an obvious answer. He could play better, even though he did lead the team in scoring at game one. I think he could play much better. Who for you is a Cav that you look at game two and say, okay, this guy has to play significantly better if the Cavs are going to even the series up 1-1?
Well, I mean, what you said earlier, it has to be J.R. Smith, because, yeah, he only had 4 points, but he was terrible defensively on the perimeter. And that's something that we didn't see against Toronto. He was great. And he did, you know, a pretty good job on Victor Oladipo in the first series. So realistically, we just need to see a lot more out of J.R. on the defensive end for me, to not let guys like Tatum or Jaylen Brown, whoever he's on, get going. And both of those guys, to an extent, got going yesterday. And realistically, for me, that hot start that Boston got out to in the first quarter, we talked about the Cavs missing easy shots, but on the other end of the court, they were giving Boston easy shots. And for, you know, a team that's younger, that's on their home court, to allow them to get settled like that, I think is what caused a lot of the Cavs problems early, and allowed Boston to get settled into a rhythm. And then the Cavs just could never come from behind as a result of all of that. But a lot of that is remedied if J.R. Smith does his job on the perimeter and is active. And realistically, yeah, the 4 points is disappointing, but J.R. is a streaky shooter, and we all know that. It's defensively and the stuff that isn't showing up in the box score that I would like to see more out of him.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I also think George Hill has to be better. I don't think he was necessarily bad in this game. I haven't watched, had a chance to like look back at his tape yet or look back at what points he gave up and whatnot, but he felt invisible in game one. And I think for what we've seen from the Cavs to some degree with him is that when he is good, he like makes an impact, even if it's slightly invisible. He obviously is not going to take over games, but he's a guy that steadies things and he can compete against guys. Now, I'm pulling up Justin Rowan's player grades from game one. He didn't turn the ball over. He had some effort on defense, but he wasn't aggressive. And when LeBron is that passive, that's not great. And I think if he could be more aggressive, if he could be take advantage of Rozier and go at Rozier, maybe get Rozier into foul trouble, help with some of the defensive effort and make some impact plays, that will go a long way. And especially if you're not going to get that from Clarkson, if you're not going to get that from Jeff Green, if you're not going to get that from Rodney Hood again, if JR has another bad game, I think Hill and to the same kind of degree, Kyle Korver, who didn't play great in game one either, especially when a shot didn't fall. He just stands out to me as a guy that's going to matter, especially when Jeff Siegel wrote a really good piece at Fear the Sword today that you can go read. The pick and roll defense for the Cavs was not good. They ran this, there's a clip that you can pull up. It's the first clip in there where Rozier and is attacking Hill in the pick and roll with Horford. It's something that, because it's Kevin Love and now it's going to be Tristan Thompson, Hill, they're going to see this play. They're going to see variations of this play. Hill is going to have to be key in that. Tristan's going to have to be key in that. And for me, if those two guys can stymie some of that pick and roll action, that's going to matter. But I think basically everyone has to play better. I don't think anyone I would classify as having a good game in game one. I don't think any of these Cavs can say, okay, I feel good about that performance. I think everyone should probably feel kind of bad about it. Obviously, Clarkson and JR were kind of the worst guys, but it'll be interesting to see who adjusts and how they adjust and who actually gets that opportunity. I wonder if we see something just crazy from Ty, at least as much as Ty can be crazy. But I'm very curious to see what kind of adjustments we get. I just don't really know what to expect. It's just, I know we're going to see Tristan starting, but with Ty and with some of the stuff we've seen so far in the playoffs, specifically in the Anna series, he was not unwilling to just throw things at the wall and see if they worked, and based on his gut feeling for game in the Pacers series. So I wonder if we see some version of that in game two and beyond, if the series does get a little bit more mucky than it was against Toronto.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there's a chance. I agree with you on, you know, on Hill and Korver. We've seen in some of the Cavs' worst games this season, later in the season, forget the playoffs, just since the trade deadline, when those two have, you know, either not played or have been invisible out on the court, that's when they've run into a lot of problems. So, yeah, I mean, 100% what you said, nobody had a good game for the Cavs yesterday. If they did, they wouldn't have got blown out the way they did. And that's just the reality of the situation. But, yeah, we've seen Ty. He loves to, you know, tinker. It's something that in a postseason series where you have time to focus on one team, I think he feels a bit more comfortable doing, almost just because, like you alluded to earlier, he has that extra time to do it. That's what makes it so much different than a regular season, you know, one-off game between these two teams, that he now has had, you know, he'll have 48 hours to try to figure out, okay, what do we do in game two to try to avoid this situation happening again?
Yeah, that's a good point as well. Looking at LeBron real quick, but we're going to talk about some other things that are going on with the Cavs right now. But looking at game two from LeBron, do you think it's what we should expect? Is it what we saw against Indiana in game two? Is that the LeBron you're expecting, or are you expecting something different? I almost am expecting LeBron to be that aggressive, because I think it's the one thing Boston doesn't have an answer for. And that, to me, is sort of why I picked the Cavs in the series in the first place, is because of LeBron. It's concerning to me that he would have to do that, but I almost think that's sort of been, it was maybe sort of inevitable in the series anyway, that he's going to have to do that. But what is that the LeBron you're expecting in game two?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. Like I said, you know, off the top of the podcast, when just talking about his pure number of shot attempts, like, I'm not going to be surprised if he has 30 shot attempts in game two. I don't think Marcus Morris, for as good as he played, and not to discredit him or Brad Stevens' game plan, I don't think he has some ultimate understanding. This is how you stop LeBron James, and I am the first person to figure it out.
Marcus Morris is not the second best LeBron defender in the league. Let's just be clear about this. Like, no shade to him. Right. He's not the second best behind Kawhi. I know I like what they did in game one against LeBron. It's the right strategy, and I think it's the optimal strategy for their roster to throw all these bodies at him, but none of them are fully capable of doing it. Marcus Smart might be their best option, but yeah.
Right. So, I mean, yeah, I'm expecting that. I think the only concern I have, and I do feel a little bit better that, you know, I think Tristan's the one who said we can't rely on that. Like, we still have to do our jobs. I mean, the only way that's a bad scenario is if role players are just become kind of complacent. And I'm like, well, it doesn't matter what I do. If LeBron drops 45, then we have a pretty good chance to win. Like, you still need everyone else engaged and, you know, not missing assignments on either end of the floor, because then that just also tends to exasperate LeBron a little bit, as we've seen. And but yeah, I mean, I don't have any reason not to think he's not going to come out twice as aggressive as he was in game one.
Because the Cavs are never boring, Tuesday is also the draft lottery. We'll have coverage of that at For the Sword on Locked On Cavs as well. Trevor Magnotti will be joining me right after the draft lottery to talk about that, because we're just going to have a little mini pod on that, because it's going to be draft season. We're going to be busy with that as well as the playoffs, at least, you know, for the foreseeable future. But Ashley, the Cavs only have a 2.8% chance of winning the lottery. It would be hilarious if they won the lottery again, considering their odds and considering their history of winning the lottery, not just with bad odds, but with other teams pick. And remember, they got Kyrie Irving with the Clippers pick. Whether it's number eight, though, or they get lucky again and end up with a top three pick if they jump up in the lottery, is there a player or two that you were just sort of interested in as we start this draft process? I don't know if you're like me and are not a big college basketball person and are just perusing the internet for some of these things, or reading features about like Luka Doncic to get excited about them. But is there anyone that you're just sort of interested in as we start this draft process?
Yeah, I mean, I'm basically exactly like you in the sense that I'm not like super big on the draft as maybe I have been in years past when the Cavs actually, like, it was a big part of their culture. But Luka Doncic was the name that you brought up that I am really interested in this draft, that I've probably researched the most. If people haven't read Mina Kimes' feature story at ESPN on him, it's great. Really, really good stuff. Good writing, good reporting, good all of that. And, you know, just going off of him, how his averages aside, just his build, how athletic he is, his confidence. I believe in Kevin Pelton's war projections, he's the best prospect in the draft ahead of DeAndre Ayton. But, you know, obviously he's only going to be available if the Cavs get a top three pick. But either between him or Ayton, if they come up in the number one with the number one pick somehow, I do think it's funny that they have the same odds to win the number one pick, the same as they did in 2011 when they drafted Kyrie Irving. So stranger things have happened, especially with this team. Obviously DeAndre Ayton gives you another true center if you do want to get away from Tristan Thompson at some point. But realistically, even if you don't get away from Tristan Thompson, I think we've seen this year the Cavs do need help in the form of another big man. And they, for as much as they like to play LeBron with four shooters, they still need that and somebody to kind of battle in the paint. And that's ever evident by game one. But like you and I think have been saying for weeks, if this pick does hold true and it ends up being the number eight spot, they're probably taking Trae Young. Like, I don't know who else it would be at that number eight spot unless he goes earlier, right?
Yeah, I've mentally prepared myself for the Trae Young experience. Danny Chow from The Ringer, one of the people that is legitimately good at The Ringer, had a joke on the Draft Class podcast about the Magic just being destined to take Trae Young, which I sort of agree with that to some degree, because it just seems like a very Orlando Magic-y thing to do. If the Cavs go top three, I'm more into Doncic and Jaren Jackson than I would be Ayton. It's just they're more modern NBA players. I like their potential fits for the Cavs. That pick, if it is top three, whether it's ammo to go get somebody to acquire to play with LeBron, it's that pick obviously becomes a lot more valuable in that way. I expect speculation around this pick to be fervent from the moment we know what it is. It's going to be out there all summer. It's the Cavs could take someone just like they took Wiggins and then trade them. It's certainly not an unquestionable thing to happen. The guy near the back end of the lottery that interests me in terms of what he could be in his fit that could be there in this range is Michael Porter Jr. He was a lot of people had him number one coming into this draft before that back injury. He's a scorer in the KD mold. He's very smooth, but he's coming off that back injury. If he's available at eight, whether LeBron leaves or not, he's the type of upset guy at that pick that I like more than a Sexton or a Shake. You, George Alexander. I also into Mikal Bridges. He fits sort of the ready-made rookie that could help LeBron right away next season. And whether this means anything or not, I did just do the draft lottery mock on ESPN. The Cavs in mine got number two behind the Phoenix Suns, with the Phoenix getting Ayton, with Doncic going to the Cavs at number two. That's obviously just a rough mock and somewhat based on prospect rankings for Jonathan Givney, who ran Draft Express and now does draft work for ESPN. But maybe that bodes well. Who knows? But I it's going to be hilarious to me if the Cavs end up with a top three pick, just because Twitter for me was never more insane than when they won the Wiggins lottery. And I just could not believe how just rampant Twitter had gotten over just the hilarity of the Cavs again getting a number one pick. And Nick Gilbert's going to be there. And he's been good luck. And he certainly, with what he's gone through, could use some good mojo in his life.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. He's out of their good luck charm and has been each year he's attended and been the rep. One last draft point I do want to make, and I believe it was Windhorse that pointed this out, is, you know, there's this narrative that LeBron is, you know, LeBron is GM basically, and the Cavs are always doing something to try to appease LeBron. But in the offseason, we kind of have to remember as a whole LeBron's, you know, what LeBron does when he's about to become a free agent. And just in the offseason in general, there typically are no exit interviews with him. It's not like the Cavs are ever really going to have time and sit down with him and be like, you know, ever talk this out, because he just goes dark. Like, that's just what he does. So when those narratives pop up, like, I just kind of discount all of them, because LeBron isn't going to have a say, and the Cavs are going to be flying blind on what he would like and, you know, all of that. The second the season ends, I think there are not going to be discussions about this between Kobe Altman and LeBron James about what would be best for this team. So I just always like to throw that reminder out there before the draft.
It's a very good point. As of note on dates wise, the lottery takes place on May 15th. The NBA draft this year is on June 21st. LeBron's player option date for next season, which will be our first indication of what he's thinking about doing for next season, is on June 29th, per the reporting we've seen out there. So it's an 8-day difference between the draft and what the Cavs do on draft night, how active they are, et cetera, and when LeBron will indicate what he wants to do, if there's going to be a situation where he comes back for a year, whether the likely option is he opts out, whether he opts in and demands a trade. All that, and Paul George is on June 29th as well, all on the table. Ashley, what do you think Cavs Twitter is going to be more into, draft lottery or game two? I kind of think it's draft lottery.
Oh, definitely draft lottery. I mean, especially if draft lottery goes well, like better than expected well. Cavs Twitter was kind of crazy the other night with panic in certain corners of Cavs Twitter, which, you know, like I said, I just don't think there's any reason to panic. So if game two, God forbid, is another bad start, I kind of hope that Cavs Twitter sticks to the draft lottery positivity, any positivity that there can potentially be.
Cue up the Trae Young first half of the season YouTube highlight clips. That's like just injected into your vein to end it with like the 9th pick. The Clippers hop into the top three and just it's just silly season. But silly season's here in more other ways than one. Game two, 8:30 on Tuesday night, NBA draft lottery Monday at 7:30, both on ESPN. Going to be a very eventful night for the Cavs franchise on two different fronts, and I can't wait to see what happens. Check out Fear the Sword, check out Locked On Cavs, and follow Ashley on Twitter at AshleyBastock42 for her inside analysis as things go on that night, and then read her work, and she'll be back on the pod, I'm sure, sometime soon. Ashley, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, I'll also warn people, inside analysis and pop culture jokes, because you're getting both if you follow me.
Lots of Veep gifts,
because, like, let's be real, you're not doing Twitter right if you're not throwing Selena Meyer at your followers as much as possible.
Yeah, if you follow me, you get like Leon Trotsky notes and books about Real Madrid and Barcelona and tweets about Atlanta. That's basically all I'm good for. But this has been Locked On Cavs for Tuesday, May 15th. I'm Chris Manning, and we'll talk to you again soon.
So that's it for today's show. Again, find Ashley on Twitter at AshleyBastock42. Find me on Twitter at CWMRights. The pod is on Facebook and Twitter at Locked On Cavs. If you want to read the Mina Kimes piece that Ashley mentioned, check the show notes. Thanks for listening. Go on iTunes, leave that 5-star rating and review, and we'll talk to you tomorrow after game two and the NBA draft lottery is official.